Hello, it's John Dennis here on Wednesday the 6th of May. Today, 77 children have gone missing from a children's home next to Heathrow Airport, which has been used as a clearing centre by child traffickers.
Two of the girls who have returned worked in brothels in the Midlands, and one, for example, was pregnant.
In Georgia, an army revolt is denounced as a Russian-backed attempted coup.
The base where there was the mutiny has been surrounded. The senior officers there have been arrested, it appears.
And in a landmark legal case, why families from Corby are blaming the council for their children's deformities.
There are a lot of factors that could have contributed to the fact that the toxic waste wasn't being cleaned up properly.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, Bill Overton with the news headlines and today's papers.
A second person suffering from swine flu died outside Mexico in the US state of Texas. A 33-year-old school teacher who had recently given birth. She'd been in hospital for 3 weeks, but doctors aren't absolutely sure it was the virus that killed her. Nearly 100 civilians are reported to have been killed in an American airstrike in Afghanistan on Monday night. The Pentagon's promised to investigate. Afghan officials say villagers brought truckloads of bodies to the regional capital of a province on the border with Iran. The US bombing raid took place to support the Afghan National Army. Open fighting started in the Swat Valley of Pakistan. A three-month truce between the national government and local authorities has collapsed. Taliban militants have taken over government buildings as they fought with the army. Meanwhile, in Washington, the US Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, Richard Holbrooke, told Congress the US needs to put the most heavy possible pressure on Pakistan to fight the Taliban. President Obama's hosting talks with the presidents of both countries today in an attempt to increase their coordinated response. Here in Britain, an economic report says we'll all have to work until we're 70 to pay for the debt caused by bailing out the banks and fighting the recession. The National Institute for Economic Research claims otherwise basic income tax will need to rise to 37%. In the All-British Champions League semi-final, it was all over in 11 minutes. That's how long it took Manchester United to score two goals at the Emirates to add to their 1-0 lead after their home leg. The game ended 3-1 to the Reds with Ronaldo scoring two. Man U Sir Alex Ferguson didn't crow with triumph after the match.
Well, I think we got a good start to the game and that makes a difference. Two quick goals like that knocked the wind out of their sail. You know, they're a young team. And I don't think level you're playing at, teams can recover from two quick goals like that, plus the fact we won 0 in the first game. So it was a mountain to climb for them. And Ronaldo in that form, well, he's a fantastic player.
So Alex Ferguson's gentle summary of his team getting to the Champions League final yet again. And Ronaldo gets on to both the front and back pages of the morning papers. No contest, United in Euro final. Ronaldo's boom leaves Arsenal bust, says The Guardian. Cristiano almighty is the way the Sun puts it, and the Mirror shouts, show me the way to go Rome. The Guardian also gives its front page to two exclusive stories. It reports that organised crime gangs have exploited a children's home beside Heathrow Airport for child trafficking. And in another story, the paper's education editor says she's been told exam boards are thinking of awarding GCSE and A-level students grades based on their coursework if schools are closed because of swine flu. The Times has that story as well, while the Financial Times leads with a government loan to save the Midlands van-making company LDV. The 11th hour £5 million loan will allow the Malaysian company Westar to take over the company and save hundreds of LDV jobs as well as suppliers. Which royals backing the Gurkhas battle? Asks the Mail on its front page. They can find the answer in The Telegraph, which claims its sources pointing to the Prince of Wales's wife, the Duchess of Cornwall. She's apparently had a long interest in veterans' affairs, while the Mail points out that the Prince is Colonel-in-Chief of the Gurkhas. There's more news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
At least 77 Chinese children have gone missing from a children's home next to Heathrow Airport. The home, run by the London Borough of Hillingdon, has been used by organised criminal gangs in a network stretching across the world. The children have been forced into prostitution, the drugs trade, and other forms of illegal labour in the UK. That's according to a report by the Border and Immigration Agency that's been obtained by The Guardian. Robert Booth has seen it.
It's a detailed report into the running of a children's home next to Heathrow Airport and the concerns that the authorities have had for some time now that Chinese children who are being cared for in the home are going missing very rapidly from that unit and are feared to have been traded into exploitation elsewhere in the UK. And the report looks at the bare statistics, really, over roughly an 18-month period, in which it finds that 77 Chinese children have gone missing from the home, which is the vast majority of those which have actually been taken into care there, and that only four of those have been found. And the question is, what's happened to them and what happens next? And that's what the report attempts to address.
And do we know what might happen next?
Well, the evidence of those that have been found is very sketchy. They apparently, from the authorities' perspective, they find these children very difficult to gather information from because they feel that the children are either afraid of their traffickers directly to them or retribution against their own families back at home. But two of the girls who have returned into the grasps of the authorities, if you like, worked in brothels in the Midlands. And one, for example, was pregnant and the other had been surgically fitted with a contraceptive device in her arm.
How has a local authority building come to be used by child traffickers?
It's as much to do with its proximity to Heathrow as anything else. Heathrow, obviously one of the world's busiest airports, if not the busiest, has been a key port in an international child trafficking network involving Chinese children. And what happens when children arrive unaccompanied, as they do in these cases, they're taken into the local authority care. So if it's at Gatwick, they're taken into West Sussex's care. If it's in Heathrow, they're taken into the care of the London Borough of Hillingdon. And that means that they are looked after by the local authority. And the local authority's first job is to try and work out who these children are, how old they are, and what their story is. And that's this centre is meant to do that.
And what's Hillingdon Council said about this?
Hillingdon Council has known about this problem for a little while and has been struggling to deal with it, but it has been trying to deal with it. They obviously feel that there's something going wrong here, but they also have a couple of hurdles which they're finding very hard to surmount, one of which is that this children's home, an assessment centre they call it, is actually inherently porous because they can't lock the children up because they're children. They can't restrict their movement. So the front door is open, the window's open, the children can go and walk to the garage and, you know, buy snacks. And they have to obtain a court order if they feel that a child is in danger and to allow them to lock them up. And they feel that establishing that with a court is very difficult. They also say that they've recently made things better there and that they've in particular succeeded in doing that by taking mobile phones away from the children when they come in, because the children often use these mobile phones, well, it is thought anyway, to contact their traffickers to alert them to the fact that they're ready to go. And they've also, you know, made efforts to vet the children when they come in and try and assess the level of risk.
Other residents living in the home have fled situations in troubled countries, including Iraq and Somalia, and have not been trafficked. I mean, is there anyone working at the home who is helping the traffickers?
I don't think there's any suggestion at all that there is anyone involved in the administration of this place who is facilitating the traffickers. There's no suggestion of that at all. In fact, one would think that it's something that they're very aware of and it's a rather painful thing for them. I mean, Hillingdon themselves have been quite open about the problem and they have in fact made appeals to the Foreign and Commonwealth Office and other branches of the government to do something about this because they want to see the trade stemmed in China before it gets to their facilities, and they want the Foreign and Commonwealth Office to, you know, send their high commissioners out into the communities in China and, you know, lobby and persuade the Chinese against this crime, really, which they are seeing the sharp end of.
Robert Booth, and there's full coverage today at guardian.co.uk/society. Also on The Guardian's website, we consider the merits of Bono's poem for Elvis at guardian.co.uk/music. We look at Mia Farrow's hunger strike for Darfur at guardian.co.uk/G2. And Adrian Searle, our art critic, reviews Luke Fowler at The Serpentine at guardian.co.uk/arts. There's been a revolt at an army base in Georgia near the capital Tbilisi. Officials claim it was an attempted military coup with Russian backing, aimed at disrupting NATO exercises taking place this week. Tom Parfitt's in Moscow with the details.
Well, what they said was that the mutiny at this base was part of a wider scale planned coup d'etat that would actually involve an armed revolt against the government, that it had been a conspiracy between senior army officers and the Russian special forces, special services. And the Interior Ministry even showed a surveillance video of one of the purported ringleaders of the coup attempt, a former Georgian Special Forces officer, who was saying that Russia had agreed to back them, that Russia would even send thousands of troops over the border and would help assassinate members of the Georgian cabinet. They did show that video, but I think we have to be fairly sceptical about such videos. Recently, the Georgian government has been using audio and video recordings that have been secretly taped to try and discredit, it appears, the Georgian opposition. So it's not quite clear how true these claims are, really.
And what's Moscow said about it?
Moscow, as you can imagine, is furious. And it says that delirium is one word that it used. It says that Saakashvili is making up these claims in order to distract attention from the fact that he's in trouble and that there are big opposition protests going on in Georgia, which have been going on now for several weeks.
How secure is the government of Georgia?
I think the immediate danger, if there ever was a danger, has been quelled now. The base where there was the mutiny has been surrounded. The senior officers there have been arrested, it appears. But I think tension is going to remain very high. Georgia and NATO are holding military exercises starting this week for the next few weeks in Georgia, and Russia has been extremely upset about that. I think diplomatic relations between Russia and Georgia are likely to remain very bad indeed.
And meanwhile, where do Barack Obama's attempts to improve relations with Russia leave Georgia?
Well, I think it's going to be a very difficult time ahead. Of course, these worsening relations between Georgia and Russia reflect directly on Russia's relationship with the West. They also come on the heels of a spy scandal. Last week, NATO ejected two diplomats from Russia's mission to its Brussels headquarters. I think the West, and particularly for Barack Obama, has a great task ahead in order to try and mend relations with Russia.
Tom Parfitt. My name's John Dennis. This is Guardian Daily. Still to come, how a British inventor came up with the idea of a digital audio player 20 years before the iPod.
I mean, certainly if you took everything out, which I did back then, what you'd have is you'd have a plastic box probably that didn't play anything today.
But first, tomorrow, a landmark case is due to close at the High Court. 18 families from Corby in Northamptonshire claim that toxins released by Corby Council during work on contaminated land affected their children when they were still in the womb, leaving them with physical and developmental defects. The council denies it's to blame. It says the children's limb defects are due to chance. Fiona Taylor helped run a pub close to the reclamation site, and her son George was born with a hand deformity.
George was born in 1992 and he had a condition called prefetal circulation, so he was in intensive care for a while. And whilst he was there, we noticed that the finger and thumb on his right hand were slightly smaller and they didn't bend. So that was the start of it, really. And we just got on with things, and he was always under, you know, the doctor for it. And as he grew, he was in an awful lot of pain. You know, cutting a long story short, by the time he got to 2005, he started to get a swelling on the back of the index finger in the hand. And they did a biopsy. which, as you can imagine, was horrendous for everybody concerned. And they found that it was a type of tumour, although it was benign. This actually resulted in George having the index finger removed in the year 2005. They couldn't give a sort of clear, sort of obvious that it wouldn't come back. And unfortunately, it did come back. And in 2007, it resulted in most of his hand being taken over by the tumour, and he had to make a decision as to whether to lose the whole hand, or he was offered some radical surgery by his orthopaedic surgeon, and he chose quite maturely the surgery. He had the operation in 2007, and this left him with his pinky and his ring finger. They took the free part of the middle finger, the wiggly part, and they turned that around and stitched it back on to try and create a new thumb. But his hand is very sort of long and narrow. He can't use the thumb, although it's still there. And that's really where we are today. So again, there's no guarantees that it's not going to come back again.
Why are you convinced that this was due to the work that Corby Council carried out on contaminated land?
Well, we were introduced to the case when George was just a few years old, and looking at all the evidence and, you know, reliving history, I suppose, if you like, and looking at things in hindsight, there are a lot of factors that, you know, that could have contributed to the fact that the toxic waste wasn't being cleaned up properly. In a prime example is a lot of some of the local contractors that lived locally actually used the pub that my husband owned of a lunchtime and an evening, and they would come in their work clothes all dirty, and you know, it would fall off and have to be damped down to be swept up and brushed up. And you know, looking back, we didn't think there was any harm in it, but this was all mud and dust from the sites that were supposed to be cleaned up under the correct guidelines. And there's an awful lot of evidence, far too much to go into just now, but there are, you know, heaps of evidence to suggest that in fact they didn't clean up the toxic waste correctly, and they knew that they weren't doing it properly.
Now, you've been fighting this legal battle for years now. I mean, what happens if the High Court decides against you this week?
I think at the moment we have to remain positive. It won't change our views in any way. We still believe that this is the cause of George's condition. There's no name for George's condition, and there's no reason, you know, for it to happen, as with all the other children. I don't really know how we'll feel, probably devastated, but life goes on, and we'll, you know, we're a positive family, and we will just get on with things as we have done for the past 11 years. But I will still believe that they are to blame.
Fiona Taylor.
Hi, I'm Jeff Jarvis with details of the latest Media Talk USA podcast. If the second richest man in the world refuses to buy newspapers at any price, what hope is there? And we speak to Craig Newmark, the founder of Craigslist, the basic-looking website that gets 22 billion page views a month.
Even now, sometimes on Daily Show, you see some of the best reporting around because they have a bunch of people, including interns, who sit around what I hear are 15 TiVos.
Out now and the first Tuesday of every month. Take the hard work out of listening and subscribe. Guardian.co.uk/MediaTalkUSA.
Media Talk USA from The Guardian and paid content.
The United Nations is to seek reparations from Israel for attacking UN premises during its military operations in Gaza earlier this year. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon made the announcement in New York, from where Ed Pilkington reports.
Well, it's a summary of a 183-page full report done by a board of inquiry that the Secretary General of the UN, Ban Ki-moon, ordered after the incidents in Gaza in which UN premises personnel were attacked. And it's a pretty hard and hitting summary. It lists six particular incidents in which it concludes that UN premises were indeed attacked by the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, and UN personnel and civilians who were sheltering in these UN premises were killed or injured. And the report goes on to say this is a violation of the UN's right to be protected in any situation. And it says that no matter what the military expediency that Israel was concerned with at those incidents, nothing gave them the right to violate the United Nations. So it's a pretty hard-hitting summary. It calls for reparations against Israel, and it also calls for Israel to be held accountable for what happened.
Why isn't the full report being released?
Well, this is a matter of some contention. Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, has just given his monthly press conference here at the UN building in New York, and he was quizzed about this. Some people have suggested that he had tried to water down the report and suggested that by refusing to publish the full 183 pages, he was sort of bowing down to Israel. He denied that very vociferously. He said categorically that the Board of Inquiry was independent, that he didn't have any right to change any of its findings, and that he only put out a summary because to produce a full report would be to breach the confidentiality of the people who had the inquiry. So we don't really know the truth in that issue, but it's likely to remain a contentious question, I think, for a while now.
Ed Pilkington. Kane Kramer invented the digital audio player back in 1979. Together with James Campbell, he built the world's first solid-state audio recorder and player, and he's also the founder of the British Inventors Society. And he spoke to our technology editor, Charles Arthur, on this week's Tech Weekly podcast.
Well, initially, my brother at the time was managing Olivia Newton-John, and she had just sold 2 million of a particular album. And we got 3 million returns. And the reason we got 3 million returns was because of the huge number of counterfeits that were produced. So the whole process started with me really thinking about, I wonder if there's a way that we can overcome the problem of all this counterfeiting. I know it would be a great idea if instead of having all these records kind of being manufactured and then introduced into the system, maybe if the record shops had a machine and the songs on the machine in the shop, they could program them onto a tape player, onto an audio cassette, and then everyone would have everything in stock all the time. I thought perhaps they could actually send it down the telephone lines to the shop, so everyone would always have everything in stock all the time. I thought, of course, this is going to sound like rubbish because it's analog, and that sort of nudged me towards, well, how can I get a brilliant quality sound down a shitty telephone line? And that led me to the concept of chopping it up into little bits and pieces and sending it down the line and then reassembling it at the other end, which we know today as music downloading.
What was your next step? Was it to, did you think, well, that's a nice idea, but I'm sure someone else will come up with it, or did you?
Well, I started to pitch it to different people, and you know, one of the problems I had was that it was very futuristic. I mean, so much so that when I did build it in 1984 and demonstrated it to people, people used to make me take the lid off so I could look inside to see if it really didn't have a record player inside. So very big change of thinking.
And did you get a patent on it?
Yes, I did, yeah. It was granted worldwide, international patent. And then I then started to approach people for investing.
So the initial patent, you got some financial help with that, didn't you?
The very, very initial application, I paid for my pocket. But then within a year, the international phase enters, and you have to make a decision to patent it all across the world. And it was quite a nerve-wracking time because I had to come up with £15,000 for this particular stage, you know, to secure the patents internationally. And I only had £7,500. At this time, I'd started talking to McCartney's outfit, Paul McCartney's outfit, and basically I pitched the idea. And so Paul was unquestionably the first musician in the world to actually believe and to see that music downloading in a digital audio device was the future, and he backed it.
If your patent was still in force today, because I believe it's expired.
That's correct.
But if it was still in force today, would it apply to the iPod?
It would apply to lots of aspects of the iPod. And of course, when you say the iPod today, it's sort of a generic term for a very broad sort of covering media player, which does all, you know, all sorts of things. Also, there's lots of specific technology. Just to give you an example, things which I didn't invent on the iPod. I didn't invent the on-off button. You know, the button that you hold down for a while and then it switches it off?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that, for example, but then neither did they. So you've got lots of little, you know, features.
But what would be covered by your patent that is in the iPod and that is in other, say, MP3 players?
There's lots of aspects to do with iTunes and the iPod itself, from how it digitizes the music, how it lays it into memory. I mean, certainly if you took everything out, which I did back then, what you'd have is you'd have a plastic box probably that didn't play anything today.
Kane Kramer. And there's more from Charles and the team on this week's Tech Weekly podcast at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey were the producers of today's show. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.